Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Circuits of Time, a home for the best in 80s movies. Grab your root beers and let's get rockin'.
It's episode 14 of the Circuits of Time podcast. It's me, JD, your host, and I'm here with my good friend and co-host,
Jaff Dog.
And it's not just Jaff Dog today. We're also being joined by a third wheel, a gooseberry. His name is Anthony. How are you, Ant?
Oh, good, thanks, boys. Happy to be on the show.
It's very good to have you. We hope you enjoy your time here. And who knows, if your voice isn't so high-pitched, we might have you back again. for those of you that follow the show, as you know, we've got a Twitter page, The Circuits of Time, at Circuits of Time. If you aren't following us, give us a check out on there. We do some movie talk, 80s style. We look into some of the did you know, the trivia, polls, all sorts of stuff. So give us a follow, give us a share and all the rest of it. J-Dog, any movie news to share this week?
Yeah, not necessarily new movie news, JD. Nonetheless, some new movie news anyway. I don't know if you're familiar with this Josh Gad chap who's been making reunions with 80s film stars and whatnot. He's done one with the Karate Kid cast. And of course, about 15 years ago, 20 years ago, we saw that that would have been like, you know, the holy grail for us. But obviously in the years since and recently, we've had things like Cobra Kai and things that were on YouTube a few years ago. So the mystery of where those characters and things went has been lost a little bit. But anyway, he's done a new one with the cast of the Karate Kid. So check it out. It's just out in time for the new series of Cobra Kai in the new year.
Oh, I've got to say, I have seen a few of those Josh Gad reunion shows, and they are really good fun. And of course, my love for Karate Kid. We haven't done a Karate Kid episode, but you'll see how I feel about that when it comes around. So I will check that one out. And mine's not so much movie news. Mine's just, we're hot on the heels of the Coming to America teaser trailer, or the Coming to America sequel, I suppose you could say, which came out, well, yesterday at the time of recording. I don't know if any of you happened to catch that.
No, JD.
No.
Oh, nothing can't know. Disappointing. Check it out. it's one of those, because the film's so beloved. We've said this in the past about, you know, trying to reinvent the wheel and try and give us stuff that we all loved 30 years ago. Whether it works, who knows, but it's something for us to look forward to either way. But moving on, it's time to discuss our movie of the episode. And you may know it from the following sound. Let it snow. And of course, if you haven't guessed it from that, I'm sure you all did. What is the film we'll be discussing, J-Dog?
Die Hard.
Die Hard. Let's get stuck into Die Hard. Give us some brief facts about this movie.
Some brief facts.
Well, it's a 1988 American action film directed by John McTiernan, who we know from Predator and later Last Action Hero, and written by two men, one called Jeb Stuart, who also wrote The Fugitive, and Stephen E. D'Souza, famous in the 80s for Commando, 48 Hours, but also in the 90s for some top drawer entertainment such as Judge Dredd and The Flintstones. It stars Bruce Willis and Alan Rickman in the lead parts. It's based on the 1979 novel Nothing Lasts Forever by Roderick Thorpe, and it was made in November 1987 on a $25 to $35 million budget.
Wonderful. Anthony, do you have anything further to add to our brief facts?
Just on the budget, it went on to gross $140 million at the box office. And it also, the role was offered to action stars at the time, like Schwarzenegger, Stallone. What happened was no one actually wanted to go for it. They thought the character was a bit soft for the time. So it ended up getting offered to Bruce Willis, and he was paid a record $5 million, became the highest earning actor at the time. The reason why, his agent said it was such a risk for his guy that he needed to be paid so much money to take it on.
$5 million now, I know to all of us, that would That would be an incredible life-changing amount. But relatively speaking, in terms of films, that's not a lot really now. The one that jumps off the page to me was in the 90s. I think Jim Carrey was paid $20 million for The Cable Guy. But obviously since then, it's just completely spiraled. And people getting paid all sorts. They're, you know, tens of millions of dollars for it. $5 million is a record-breaking amount. It just seems so tiny now in comparison, obviously, relatively speaking.
It does. But what I would say to that is, you know, forgive me if I'm being ignorant, but Bruce Willis wasn't the big star that we know him as today. It was big bucks for someone like that. It was a relatively unknown, wasn't he?
Yeah, it's almost like he's punching above his weight.
I think that's why he asked for that much money in the first place. He's basically saying, you've got no one if you want me. Here's what I want.
Well, like, ask for $5 million and hope for three.
Wise words. Let's go on and talk about what Die Hard's all about. Anthony, why don't you kick us off with the plot as best as you can.
Movie synopsis.
It is basically down to a Christmas love story. It's about a husband and wife who've grown apart. She's taken a job in LA. He's from New York. They've been living apart for several months. And he goes over there at Christmas time to try and sort of make amends. Most guys will take flowers and chocolates, but in this scenario, he had to defeat some terrorists / bank robbers and save a load of hostages. That's basically the premise of the story.
Well said. Anything to add to that, J-Dan?
No, do you know what? I couldn't have put it better myself, actually. And the way Anne told it, it sounded, hold on a sec, this sounds more like a Matthew McConaughey rom-com.
Let's move on and talk about Die Hard then. Let's get stuck into this film and some of its themes and some of the things that, you know, cry out to us. What is Bruce Willis, a good guy? Is he all-round good guy? He's a little flawed, isn't he? What we're seeing in those early scenes is that, would you say he was a flawed guy?
Flawed or normal guy would be the term I'd use.
Mm.
He's not your general action hero, if that's what you mean by flawed, as in the way of he's not this big macho butch character who can pick someone up with the one hand. He's just a normal cop from New York, goes out to LA for Christmas time. So he ends up battling these bank robbers on his own. Very intelligent bank robbers, as it happened to be. So flawed, maybe not the way that I'd use, just a normal guy, maybe.
Yeah, that's a fair point, that Ant, actually. And what really I noticed from the start of the film, looking at it with a critical eye after these years, it was made in 1988 or 87, 88. And at that time, the action movie star was now a thing. It was a meme of its own. And so the film, and we can discuss this later, gives reference to all of those things. In many of these films, and if I think of Commando, because that was written by one of the same people, when you first see Arnold Schwarzenegger in that film, he emerges from the forest and you see his muscles before you see his face. In this film, you see a man, a normal-looking man, as you said, not a huge guy, certainly with a lot of masculine traits, for sure, which you see in the film, but not in that, you know, WWF-style, huge, cartoonish, grotesque size. The first thing that we see him actually doing is shaking with fear. And it's when he's on the plane. So we're thinking, hold on, is this guy our hero? He's sat on a plane, he's shaking with fear, he's worried about things, so we can empathise with him in that way. So he is different, and there is something different about him.
So would you say it's more vulnerability than flawed?
Oh, definitely, JD. What do you reckon, Ant?
I'd say definitely, especially compared to the action heroes at the time.
Do you know what? One of the things I was noticing about this film is that he's a lone hero, isn't he? I know you were referencing some films then. One of the things I noticed, J-Dog, was that he's a lone hero in many respects. I know later on in the film he has some help from some unexpected aides, but for the most part he's that lone hero that we see often in that era. The Arnold Schwarzenegger, if you like, the one man against the whole army kind of action flick.
Yeah, and I think that stereotype or that archetype of a character certainly emerges in the 1950s and 60s with the spaghetti westerns. And then that evolves then into the Dirty Harry type characters, the one man against the bureaucracy, until eventually we emerge into the 80s, where we do have, it goes on a sort of exponential scale, doesn't it? From this lone individual to a lone individual who happens to be more like a computer game character than a real life person. So for Die Hard to reference all of those things, but also pull it back to the essence of one man and he's vulnerable, it was a really nice touch for that film.
And it's not long, is it, until we actually finally come to the location of the movie, correct me if I say it wrong, is it the Nakatomi Plaza?
I think that's right, yeah.
Is that right, J-Dog? Am I saying that right?
It is, yes. Very good. Your accent is very much of the northwestern prefectures, so very good. Well, but the building in itself is a character, in my
opinion. Well, that's what I was going to say to you, yeah.
And that's one thing that these films do well. The first film, it's a building. The second film, it's the airport. And in the third film, it's the playground of New York City itself.
So let's quickly, he arrives at the Nakatomi Plaza, and it's there he obviously finally sees that his wife doesn't go by the same surname as our hero, John McClane. What can we read into that, Anthony? What's going on there?
Well, it's obvious she's an independent woman. She's obviously got this role offered to her, and we do find out later she's doing quite well. She's like second in command or something like that in the business. So she's a strong, independent woman. She's got this job, she's took it, and she's obviously decided, my husband hasn't come with me, maybe I need to show I'm not led by a man, I'm my own woman. And she does develop into a strong character throughout the rest of the movie from that.
And of course John isn't so dissimilar himself. The reason, and I think this is the when he's picked up by his limo driver Argyle, who we can discuss a bit later on, an amusing character, I think he himself susses out that the reason John didn't go along to California with his wife is that John himself was committed to his job and his work. They were both career people. And of course, that was ultimately at the expense, or certainly the strain of the relationship, J-Dog.
Yeah, and there's that really interesting scene when they first see one another again, and there's a spark there between the two of them. And yet within 5 minutes, they're arguing again, just as if they're still together and still married. So you're thinking, won't they? And we know now from the sequels that they don't. Spoiler alert, sorry to anyone who's not seen the Die Hard trilogy, wherever you've been the past 25 years. But you would like to think that there's a goal. If he survives this onslaught, he's going to, you know, the classic case, get the girl back in the end.
Doesn't at the end she say her name's McLean? It's like sort of the wrapping it up as he's succeeded.
Ah,
yeah. So it was all worthwhile, like all that death, all that.
At the end of RoboCop, actually, one of the other films which we've reviewed, check it out. Somebody says, "What's your name?" And he says, "Murphy," or something like that. He refers now back to the fact that he's a human character again. Or the end of Commando as well, when he walks off back to the plane with his girlfriend and his girl.
So this is the point in the film, isn't it, where we are introduced to a few more characters. You've got Ellis, who I think is up there for the biggest douchebag in movie history. And then, of course, you've got the boss himself. And forgive me if I pronounce his name wrong. Is it Tagat? I need really help on this. And, it's very poor of me as a show host to not come prepared. Tagaki? Is it something like that?
Takaki or something like that.
Well, let's go for Takaki, and someone can correct us if it's poor, but we do apologise. He's an interesting guy. He's this big, wealthy businessman who's got this huge plaza. You know, it's all bravado. They're having a champagne reception, albeit I know it's Christmas time, and John McClane's wife, do we say it's his wife, or is it his spouse or his partner? Is it ever mentioned that she's the married? Is that right?
I think from the fact he typed McClane in when he walked into the building, suggests he must have had his name previously and they were married, yeah.
We'll assume that. But she's obviously been given a fancy watch, hasn't she, by the boss. So what are we to read into this guy? Is the film trying to give us a message about the world that, you know, where we are and the plaza? J-Dog, any thoughts?
Yeah, the building that it was filmed in, by the way, was for a Did You Know, but it's more appropriate here. The building that it was filmed in was the brand spanking new 20th Century Fox building, which was still getting finished, actually, when the film was made. And it's very symbolic of that 80s style, you know, wealth, huge building jutting up into the sky. Everything sleek, shiny, grey, 80s grey. So the building itself represents this huge organisation I believe they're involved in stocks, shares, or something like that. The Christmas party that you mentioned isn't just a Christmas party, though. When they're discussing it in the office, the sleazy guy, who, by the way, by the time you've recognised and realised he's a very sleazy guy, has probably said a handful of words, so quite good acting, I'd say. He says something like, well, it's a double celebration, not only for Christmas, but also something to do with making a big sale or something like that. So obviously they worship money, this company, whatever they do.
I'll also just mention, he also sent the limo to pick up John McClane from the airport. And you see John McClane sitting in the front seat with Argyle. So it shows his contempt for that side of the world, the business, big business, the money. He's not bothered about that, where obviously his wife, Holly, is. So they do compete there.
I never noticed that he was sat in the front. That's a good point, that actually.
It's one thing I've noticed, and that's why I was kind of trying to push it towards talking about the Plaza, and because the film I found, and that's a good point, Anthony, the film definitely seems to be sending a message to me about John and his relationship to that kind of lifestyle. Can we read anything politically into that, you know, about the wealth and the power and the destruction of it all?
Yeah, I mean, far from it from me to mention Reaganomics.
But so, you know what we need to do going forward? Every time you say it, we just have that ping, that check ping, or some sort of sound to say that we've achieved this every episode.
Well, if we make a drinking game out of it, we'll all be rat arse by the end of the episode. But yeah. I think it says a lot about the 80s. By this point in the 1980s, on both sides of the Atlantic, wealth was very much the be-all and the end-all. So, yeah, that company definitely represents something about wealth and the importance of money in Western culture. But it's also interesting that we talk about Western culture. It's a Japanese company that's also involved in it. There's an interesting line from Mr. Tagaki. He says something along the lines of, well, we didn't manage to get you a Pearl Harbor, but we've got you with the double tape deck or something like that. You know, so it's about, I guess you've got two cultures there, haven't you? The West and the East.
And I'd also, to jump on the back of that, because the film sends, it seems to have a lot of clashes of style, if you like, or, you know, polar opposites. You've got the blue collar versus the white collar workers. You've got John McClane, who's the New York hard-nosed cop, against the California kind of laid-back approach. Did anyone else pick up on that, Ant?
I'd say yes. Slick approach, I think. Very well-organized, well-oiled machine of bank robbers. John McClane comes over with his New York ways of hustle bustle, you know, big bang bosh sort of job, wasn't it?
And of course, he's barefoot, isn't he?
I think that was the show. He's also vulnerable. We see him pulling glass out of his feet at one point, and there's blood. That's maybe a reference to that. He's not just the big action hero. He's a vulnerable man. He's running around in bare feet, trying to fight these slick bad guys.
Did you pick up on that, J-Dog, about his bare feet? And is there anything we can read into that?
Yeah, the barefoot thing says that he's naked almost in a way, obviously combined with the vest that gets progressively filthier as time goes on. He does. He shakes off all of his... He's down to nothing really, isn't he, by that point in the film? But just coming back to the formality and the world, one world, the East versus West Coast. It seems to me that when John gets off the plane or just at the end of his journey, everyone who he speaks to is quite certain about who they are and where they're going. So the guy on the plane who he speaks to is a confident businessman. He's the one who gives the advice about if you're ever unsure of yourself in a hotel room, rub your feet. Was it rub your feet on the carpet with your socks on? Which is actually a good tip, actually. Try that one.
Just about that point on the plane, yeah. He is a confident businessman. He's giving tips to John. Try this out, try that. Oh, you look like a nervous flyer. And then when he spots John's gun in his holster, rolls reverse, and he's sort of a bit nervous then, and John McClane gets a bit of a boost from that.
That's true, that is true, yeah. And then he leaves the airport and he meets Argyle, who, I'd say only, but, you know, he's got a job which is... probably not the best paid job, but even he's suited and booted. He's very confident in himself when he's telling John about LA. Holly Gennaro is his ex-wife. She's confident of herself. You know, here's John. He's even the way he dresses tells us about his manner and style. He's nervous. He's nervous on the plane, but also he just wears like a loose shirt, doesn't he? That's unbuttoned. Everyone else is all suited up and, you know, looks a lot more formal, a lot more smart.
Let's move on and talk about the turning point in the movie, which is the arrival, of course, of these international terrorists. It's interesting, isn't it, how they're always foreign at this time of this time of movies. They turn up, don't they? And their overall goal, I think, obviously, the real aim is to open this vault, isn't it? Which takes the bulk of the movie. What is it in the vault? Did he say something about bombs? Am I right there?
Yeah, when we finally do see what's in there, there's these huge sheets of paper that are worth something like $100,000 each, which I thought, where are you going to spend those? You know, wouldn't they be known? It's a bit like when people steal artwork, isn't, you know, someone's going to know where those things are, so I don't see the point in that. And wouldn't all those banknotes just be cancelled straight away? But that aside, it's a bit of a bluff, isn't it? Isn't the original intent that they wish, or rather they tell the police that they wish for certain people from different liberation groups or terrorist cells there to be released, but that's actually a bluff? Is that right, Ant?
That's correct, yeah. That is a bluff. At one point, he turns around and says, I just read about them in a magazine or something. but the overall aim is to rob the bank. I think in the book, they are terrorists, and I think it was the director, McTierney, who said, I don't want terrorists, I want robbers. People can relate to robbers more. So it was changed. So maybe that part of releasing people, I haven't read the book, but it could have been something from there.
Yeah, that's a good point, that actually. And I haven't read the book either. In fact, if I'm going to be honest with our listeners and you guys, I didn't know it was based on a book until I did the research for this podcast. And when I was reading about the novel, which was written in 1979, I believe, there's so many things that are just changed or tweaked ever so slightly. So, for example, it's not his wife, it's his daughter. She's still inviting him to a party, but it's his daughter. In that case, changes to names of characters and things like that. But it's amazing just how closely the movie follows. It deviates, but at the same time follows so much. But that Argyle character, I don't think he's in it at all. Do you know any more about it, Ant?
Just another point where you just picked up on the changing the things. I did read that. In the book, he, you know, the pit where he goes to put the dead guy's shoes on that's too small?
Yeah.
In the book, it's actually, he doesn't want to wear dead man's shoes, so he just doesn't put them on.
Oh, okay, fair enough. Yeah, I mean, even in the midst of a situation like that, I think, yeah, that's not really something that I'd feel comfortable doing either, to be fair.
So moving back to talking about these international terrorists, they're clearly smart guys, you know, intelligent. They're certainly well prepared. They've thought of everything, haven't they? From, you know, the fake IDs and how to take care of the foyer, the elevators, and everything. So, let's talk about some of these bad guys, because obviously, how many do we find out there is in the end? Roughly 10, 8 to 10 of them.
There were 12 originally, I believe.
There was 12 original. Were they believable? How did we find their presence? Were they a believable threat? And of course, let's maybe think about, what would they have done, obviously, post retrieving these bombs? What was the plan of escape? But before you say that, let's quickly talk about whether they were a good villain, if you like. Did you find them intimidating? Did you think they were a good presence, Ant?
Yeah, definitely. They're all tall. They're all blonde, mostly.
So not all blonde.
The faces are very angry looking. I think one of them was actually a ballet dancer and was picked for the role because of the way he looked.
Yeah, he's an interesting guy, this Alexander, I can't remember his exact name, forgive me. He wasn't actually German, this guy. He was a Soviet defect. He was a ballet dancer and he came from Russia to, or East Germany, I'm not quite sure, to dance with the Bolshoi Ballet. And whilst he was in New York, he defected to the United States, said he didn't want to go back. And I believe the KGB spies who were in the United States got his wife and tried to send her back to the Soviet Union. So God knows what would have happened to her when she went there. I think the plane was stopped on the runway. And there was actually a film made about this incident itself. So he's an interesting guy. And he died in 1995, actually quite young. Unfortunately, he was an alcoholic. So he died quite young because of that. But yeah, there's an interesting story from that. Actor and ballet dancer, should I say, himself.
I believe only a few of them actually spoke German. Most of them were just non-German speakers. You know, most of the lines that you can see, especially Alan Rickman, we know was English anyway. So all the German is probably made up, as I'd say.
Yeah, I think it would be a bit like, you know, when you hear someone from England who's not from Liverpool trying to speak with a Scouse accent. It's a really exaggerated form, isn't it? And the dialect's all wrong and it just doesn't sound right. And the inflections are all in the wrong places. You know, when you think of a German accent or a French accent or an Italian accent, to a native speaker in many cases, that would probably be quite offensive. But certainly Alan Rickman's attempts at... I put it this way, his American accent is much better than his German.
I think what I would say, and to the credit of the filmmakers and some of the casting choices, and with regards to the terrorists, is that although Alan Rickman, or Hans Gruber, should we say, is the lead villain, the other guys, typically you'd think in that era, you just see them as kind of background henchmen, but actually they all seem to have a bit of a presence. There's the guy who's obviously trying to get into the vault. You've obviously got the infamous villain who's hanged, or we believe him to be dead, and comes back right at the end, only to be killed by the wonderful sidekick who we can talk about shortly. So they all seem to offer something different, and it's to the credit of the filmmakers, isn't it, and the casting choices.
Yeah, considering it's a one-man mission, all of the characters are quite well-rounded. What was always interesting to me was the one bad guy who wasn't actually German. He was the computer expert, looked a bit like Steve Urkel. And this guy, you know, he hacks all the computers. And anything with a computer in the 1980s interests me, because obviously computers weren't, not everybody had them, did they? So in those days, they could do anything on screen. And when he's securing the elevators and the doors and things like that, it's one of those situations where the screen has got it in, you know, in clear writing, exactly what's happening, the elevator's doing this and that. And you think in real life, for the person operating that, they wouldn't need to see it written out in plain writing for them. They'd know that when they press this button or type this command in, that's what's going to happen. But instead, because we're the stupid movie going people, we have to see now closing elevator or 90% or, you know, that sort of thing.
And you know, it's one of those things that it always takes me out of the movie-going experience when that happens, because you just feel totally manipulated. It's like, these directors and writers don't trust me to get what's happening. And, you know, you see that even now, you know, 30 years later. It's just one of those things, I'm afraid. But anything further to add with regards to the international terrorists and, of course, Hans Gruber?
Well, I'd say, actually, in the German version, the bad guys weren't actually German. They changed it they were a bunch of Irish terrorists, which created a plot hole, certainly with the third film, because when Hans Gruber's German brother turns up. But yeah, they changed it so that they were German. They changed it so that they were actually Irish terrorists.
Did they do an Irish accent for the German film?
So, of course, at the end of the film, our lone hero, with the help of some of the armed forces who turn up in various forms. You've got the local cop in the form of Al, who obviously becomes Bruce Willis's counterpart, if you like, a sidekick towards the end of the film. And then, of course, you have the sergeant, if you like, who I believe when I seen him, he was the principal from The Breakfast Club. Is that right, J-Dog?
Do you know this guy? I'd never actually knew of him. He'd not really crossed my consciousness until we researched for the podcast about The Breakfast Club. And ever since then, he's popped up everywhere. I've seen him in a couple of films since, actually, JD. One of which being this, of course, and a couple of other films where I've gone, that's the vice principal there from The Breakfast Club, Paul Gleason.
Yes. And then, of course, after that, we see the introduction of the FBI. In fact, it's one of the Fratelli brothers, isn't it, from The Goonies?
Yeah, and Andrew Davy.
I believe so. I like the fact that we go from the local cop to kind of the head of the sergeant, if you like, and then, of course, you've got the FBI, and it keeps on getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And I think that's the film's just way of showing, you know, the stakes are getting bigger. And, of course, if this was to happen in real life, if there was a hostage situation, 30 people's lives on the line, you would have that kind of level of law enforcement. So it was good to see, because I did think at one point, you know, we need to up the ante, if you like, from a response point of view, and they certainly did in Die Hard.
And it also seems to be, to me, the more up and up they go to the sergeant, the FBI, the more annoying and incompetent they become, as certainly from when you look at just the Al Powell, he seems quite down to earth and knows what's going on, and he's the lowest rung, as it was.
Yeah, fair point, Arant, actually. Both John McClane and Al, they are the ones who were at the difficult face of the job, and yet they are the most down-to-earth and normal people. And you're right in that the further up the scale you get, the more strange they become, and the more, you know, supposedly professional, but in actual fact, that the less they actually know about what's going on.
And I suppose Al is similar to John, because, of course, we have the moments towards the end of the film when we find out that he himself has got some vulnerabilities. He's not... I can't remember how the dialogue flows, but we learn that, of course, he shot a kid, which was a bit of a strange segue. It just seemed to come out of nowhere, didn't it? But it kind of gives us a glimpse into, you know, the kind of man Al is. He, like John, of course, has these vulnerabilities, and hence why, I suppose, they seem to get on so well.
Yeah, there's the potential there that had he not had that accident that happened, then he would have become a detective himself. So you start to get into the realm there of the what if. You know, is he the sort of West Coast equivalent of John McClane? And then what would a buddy cop movie with those two in look like? Certainly around the time of Lethal Weapon's release and many, many other buddy cop films that were out at that time.
Did you know?
Let's use this opportunity to move on and talk about maybe some of the things that maybe some of our listeners have never knew about Die Hard. They may have watched this film 20, 30 times, but there might just be something that they missed or some interesting trivia that we can provide. So without further ado, let's move on.
Well, a little bit of trivia is about when the movie was released. I know, Joe, you mentioned before about the Nakatomi Plaza being, you know, a main character. On the actual previews in the cinema, they found that the audience was laughing because it was Bruce Willis, and they'd only seen him in like moonlighting, and he was a funny character. So they took him off the poster and just replaced it with the tower itself. And only after a few weeks, when the movie started doing well, they put his face back onto the poster.
See, that's really good, and I like that one, because I giggled quite a bit throughout this movie. But it's to the film's advantage that there is that kind of comical side to John McClane. Because I think the film could be almost too brutal, if you like. It's 2 hours, isn't it? It's a long time to sit through an action film and it just be cold, hard and bloody. It's nice that he's got these softened edges and a bit of comedy value, isn't it?
Yeah, I think at the time as well, not only was Bruce Willis in the TV series Moonlighting with Cybill Shepherd, but he was also doing albums. He was a potential music star. If you've ever heard this version of Under the Boardwalk, then it's it's a treat for the ears.
That's one of my old karaoke classics. I'll be checking that one out.
Another fact was that when they asked, and I might be able to say this as good as J-Dog did, Stephen D'Souza, is it?
Stephen E. D'Souza.
That's the one. When he was asked to rewrite it, they already had the scheduling for filming, and it was in a couple of weeks. So he was basically writing the script a week or two in advance. So it was very, very tough to basically write it and then, you know, go in. So he had to go into the building, look around and just work with whatever he had. As you mentioned, a couple of floors were still under construction. So he'd just say, oh, let's use that. I think one of them was the chain. He hung one of the bad guys with his out. There's a chain there. Let me write that into the script. So it was a very, very tough schedule for the rewrite. And like you say, he was brought in to make it more funny because the director wanted the comedy element to the film.
Oh, that's really interesting. You know, if you it just goes to show, if you've got a good idea, then you can always work on it and flesh it out and get it out there in that way that you go, okay, well, this would work here and this would work here. Because some of the things that are on television or in films, they spend years in the planning and yet they can be absolute garbage. But this, they've clearly just worked with what they had. So, yeah, really, really good.
Off that point again about rewriting, at the end, he still didn't have an ending to the film. He had no idea how the bad guys were going to escape. He hadn't wrote that. They were coming up to the final filming. And he said, oh, previously I've done a movie. And in the back of the van, there was an ambulance that they used to get away. So they wrote it in, filmed the ambulance coming out of the van. And on the first screening, 20 minutes in, they realised there's a clip of all the bad guys walking out of the van and there's no ambulance in there. So it doesn't always work in your advantage to not plan the movie from the start.
What about you, J Dog? Anything for us in the did you know?
Okay, just to get us started, then I'm going to reel off a list of names, and you're going to tell me who these names were considered for. Arnold Schwarzenegger, Sylvester Stallone, Richard Gere, Clint Eastwood, Harrison Ford, Burt Reynolds, Nick Nolte, Mel Gibson, Don Johnson, Richard Dean Anderson, Paul Newman, James Caan.
Well, it can only be John McClane.
Yeah. As Ant mentioned before, this role was passed around to so many people. It's unbelievable. It's probably got to be one of the most previewed characters in movie history. It's so strange that nobody wants to actually touch it.
It's true, and of course, I even read that it was even offered to Richard Dean Anderson, who you may know as MacGyver.
Yeah, I did mention MacGyver, actually. Yeah, what a legend he was, yeah.
So there you go.
Now, the other interesting person who's involved here, from all of those interesting names, Frank Sinatra actually had first dibs on playing the role of John McClane in Die Hard. And the reason for that was because he had made a film years before called The Detective. And I haven't seen The Detective, but I've heard that it's one of the first films to show the investigative process, but in quite a detailed and grisly way and much more realistic and the kind of thing that you'd expect to see now. But because he was still under a contract, he had first dibs on this film. And also the book that the film was based on had some sort of relation to The Detective as well. He was actually 73 at the time. So I think the name Die Hard could have been quite apt.
I believe, J-Dog, it was Sinatra himself who requested a new book be written because he wanted to make a sequel to True... what was it? Not True Detective. That's a TV show.
The Detective.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So it was the same. It was the same writer who wrote both books, The Detective, and then.
So he didn't ultimately like the script that was put out, and when he went into the production company, he just basically walked into the room and said, "I'm going to do it my way." Sorry, guys. Anything else, J Dog?
Yeah, actually, also, is it true that before he went to Los Angeles, as he was getting on the plane, he started to say to people, start spreading the news, I'm leaving today.
Just stop.
Okay. In 1980, Bruce Willis actually made his film debut. It was a crime thriller called The First Deadly Sin. He doesn't have a name, and it's more one of these blink if you'll miss it kind of cameos, but he actually entered the diner as Frank Sinatra's character left it. So they're just in the running theme of Frank Sinatra.
A nice tie-in.
Now, well, did you know that Alan Rickman was... Well, actually, you tell me, how old do you think Alan Rickman was when he made this film?
Oh, do you know what? It's one of them. Because he's got that mature look with, you know, debonair and the suit, you would imagine that he was probably intended to be look around 40 to 50, but sure, he would have been quite younger. I would say he was closer to about 33.
I would say, I think he was actually older because he'd just done a lot of stage work, hadn't he? I think he was about 40.
And you win the shards of glass for your feet because he was 41 years of age at the time and it was his first feature film. And he does bring a stagey presence, doesn't he, with all of the looks and the sly looks and the drama that he brings to it and the theatrics of it. Slightly camp, very charismatic, but it doesn't ever become too over the top, which is a skill, obviously a skill of the actor himself.
Well, I did read that he flinched a lot when the guns went bang. So the director had to turn the camera away just as the gun went bang off his face because he didn't have the demeanour of a cool, calm, bad guy when the gun went off.
Is that something to do with the sound department wanting the guns to, or the director wanting the guns to sound much more realistic?
I assume so, yeah.
Yeah, I believe that a lot of the sound clips that they actually had in their sound libraries were recorded in the 1950s. So they just didn't suit the modern weaponry and what the director was looking for. So they had to re-record all of the sounds and they used a certain type of blank as well when they were filming, which gave that sound effect, which made Rickman flinch. Did you know that Reginald Vell Johnson, who plays Argyle, he said, I didn't really notice this, but maybe I just wasn't paying attention at the time. Does his character say or eat Twinkies?
Yes.
Okay, right.
I thought it was, I think John McClane at some stage is eating a Twinkie, and then he starts asking about the ingredients, and Al knows the ingredients of a Twinkie. Something like that, isn't it?
Okay. So it's not like one of these big things, is it?
I think, isn't he, when he gets the call to go down, he's buying Twinkies in the shop. And he's like, this is my wife. He's like, sure. He's like, no, she's pregnant. Sure she is. Oh. I thought you guys only ate donuts.
Oh, that's right, yeah. Yeah, but it's not, you know, it's not like one of those brilliant character traits, is it? That you think, wow, you know, what a memorable guy. I love Die Hard because there's a character in there who eats Twinkies a lot. People would buy these Twinkies and throw them at him or give them to him for some reason. And I just thought that was really strange because it's not like it's one of these big mega things for the character. And he's not even a main character anyway. He's, in my opinion, an annoying sidekick, if I'm being honest.
I mean, but maybe that's us being Brits and not really, you know, kind of attaching ourselves to the word Twinkie. We just kind of dismiss it. Maybe it's quite a prominent word for our American friends.
Yeah, but why is it that people think that they, when someone's being on screen, that they, it's almost like they own that person and they can do whatever they want to them and say whatever they want to them? It would be horrible to have been in. I know he was in a few things, but he's probably going to be best remembered for that. And that's the thing that people remember you for.
So he's the Twinkie guy. Basically.
The Twinkie guy from Die Hard.
Well, JD, it's your turn now to spill the beans on the Did You Know. Do you have anything for us that we haven't mentioned already?
Well, I did and I do. I'm afraid some of the beans have already been spilled by you two, so you've stole a lot of the thunder already. But some of the ones you didn't pick up on in your research, did you know that the movie rights were originally owned by Clint Eastwood? Or I think it was. I think he was a big fan of the book, and obviously that was his kind of way into obtaining the movie rights. And of course, he planned to star in it. I actually think it would have been quite good with Clint Eastwood.
He was too busy recording something like Every Which Way But Loose, the one with Clyde the orangutan.
Well, he made the right choice, clearly. But here's an interesting one for you: Sam Neill, who you may remember as Dr. Alan Grant from Jurassic Park, was originally approached to play the role of Hans Gruber. But when the casting director saw Alan Rickman playing Valmont in a stage production of Dangerous Liaisons, they knew that they'd found their Hans, which I thought was really good. I think Sam Neill actually wouldn't have been a bad choice either, would he?
No, he wouldn't have actually. You know, whenever you say that name, though, for me, there's only one role that comes to mind.
Dr. Alan Grant.
No, I was going to say Event Horizon. Yeah, of course, yeah.
Move on. Here's one which I thought was a bit interesting. And it's one of those, it's kind of like, it's very impressive, but at the same time, you almost regret reading about it because you don't want the movie magic to be kind of eroded. So anyone that doesn't want the movie magic to be eroded for Die Hard, I suggest you put your fingers in your ears for the next 20 seconds. But did you know that the panoramic view of the city below isn't real at all? In fact, it was a state-of-the-art 380 feet long background painting fitted with animated lights to show moving of traffic and the ability to change from night and day. Now, I'm not quite sure whether that's just in some scenes of the movie, because, of course, there's one scene that I immediately think of is when John thinks that he's, I think he sets the fire alarm off and he thinks that the emergency response is on its way to the building. Now, I don't know about you two, but that looks real as hell to me. And if that is a state-of-the-art painting, then kudos to the prop makers and that, because that was impressive.
Yeah, the lengths that they went to in the old optical effects days to get something to look good on camera were just phenomenal. This was certainly towards the end of the 80s, and you're looking about 89 with film called The Abyss, James Cameron, which used CGI to, it was one of the first films to use it to some extent prior to him making Terminator 2, Judgment Day. At that point, of course, using all of these paintings, and you talked about it in the last episode, matte paintings or matte decoration or something like that, it's called. It's just amazing that people had that job to do that and the skill required and the effort. It shows a lot better on camera, I think, than rudimentary early CGI, and all CGI eventually dates and ages. And it just, it says a lot about the skill of the movie making.
It does. And it's quite surprising to read about because it seems more costly to have done that, doesn't it? And it almost seems almost too difficult, but that was the route they chose. And the fact that I only found out about it through my research is obviously credit to the filmmakers. And my last one, bit of trivia, was that Bruce Willis actually suffered permanent hearing loss from shooting the film. It was an interview that he did not long ago with a British newspaper.
Oh,
and he said that the guns that you used...
the reason why I said, oh God, is because when you said Bruce Willis, an interview, those are two or three words that don't quite go together. He's not known for his... He's known for being a pain in the neck, basically, when he's being interviewed. Sorry, go on.
No need to apologise. Of course, you've got someone, I think Russell Crowe's sort of got the same kind of... I think he's a bit of an arse with the press as well, isn't he? Maybe for good reason, but I divulge. But yeah, he was doing an interview some years back with the British newspaper, and he said about the blanks that were used in the guns, and they were modified to be extra loud for the effect. But in the scene where he's under the table and he shoots the terrorist, he said that due to the close proximity and the rate of the fire, he basically has two-thirds partial hearing loss in his left ear. And if you actually listen to Bruce Willis in some of his interviews, you do notice he often asks people to repeat. I've actually seen that before, and I never obviously knew it was anything to do with hearing loss, but there you go. It was due to the scene in Die Hard. In fact, it's one of the more prominent, famous scenes, the shooting the terrorist under the table. But unfortunately, it had a bit of an unfortunate side twist for Bruce himself.
Yeah, I mean, it's a shame, isn't it, that he actually heard his agent say, let's do a sequel to The Whole Nine Yards, it'll be a good idea, and agreed to it.
I mean, whoever greenlit the first should have had the long talk. Anyway, let's go on and talk about some of the feedback that we've had from our followers.
Listener feedback.
Okay, so we put out our tweet earlier in the week to see what you guys all thought of Die Hard. And you were very generous. We had some good responses come in. And the first one was from Christina M. at McNairy K, who said, I've seen it many times. My teenage daughter hadn't. So we watched it last Christmas. And at the end of it, she said, yes, this is a Christmas movie. Bong Ripper, Jack Tripper at Libodi went on to say it's 100% a Christmas flick. Marty Giannetti, Marty Eastrad, I think I've recognised a few of these names from earlier episodes, who said, can't believe that Mrs. McLean is Macaulay Culkin's real-life auntie. There you know, a bit of trivia that we didn't pick up on. AC Junior, Ohio at Sewerman69 said it's a classic. I'm on the fence, though, as to whether it's a Christmas movie or not. Let's just quickly take a quick segue and kind of cut in here. I suppose it's appropriate, given that our first four tweets have talked about the fact that this is a Christmas flick. Why is that contentious? Why does that continue to be asked? I suppose the easiest way to approach that would be, and without kind of take too long, because I know people get sick of it, is what constitutes a Christmas movie? Does it need to be filmed around? Does it need to be released around Christmas? What would you say, Ant?
Well, let me just say, for me, it is a Christmas movie. Well, it's just not your standard run-of-the-mill Christmas movie, is it? I think that's where some people struggle to see it in that light, because it is, you know, it is an action flick, and not your jingle all the way type of action flick. It's just got hints of Christmas. There's the bit where, you know, he pushes the bad guy out of the window onto Al's car, and it's saying "Let it snow." He's got "Let it snow" in the car as the guy's coming down to smash on his windscreen. There's the teddy bear that he takes with him as a present, sitting in the back of the limo. So hints of Christmas without it being full on Christmas, and I think that's the difference.
Yeah, I think in a lot of films we're so used to the perfect Dickensian image of Christmas, the snow, and everyone's wrapped up warmly. But in Los Angeles, the temperature's pretty stable all year round. So you don't tend to see people wrapped up in that way that we tend to see in films traditionally. So I think the clothing and the costumes certainly add towards that Christmas feeling of a film, as it were. But it comes back to something we talked about in Gremlins, JD, in that the film itself was released in the summer. in the same way to the way Gremlins was released in the summer? And is it the case that sometimes that hangs around the film many years after it's been released? Because marketing, as we know, is a huge, huge part of how a film sticks in the public's memory, the public's mind. I wouldn't necessarily put it down as a Christmas film because it's not thematically Christmas. It's set in Christmas, not thematically Christmas.
I suppose, well, that's nice, kind of, because, of course, we've got one advocate that it's a Christmas movie, and of course, J-Dog, who doesn't exactly put it into the Christmas category. I suppose I'm somewhere in the middle. There's enough nods to Christmas for it to be kind of justifiably referenced as a Christmas movie. In fact, you probably don't go 5 minutes in this film without hearing some nod to Christmas or some sort of Christmas melody. And of course, the fact, I suppose the big criteria for me is, what time of year do you watch it? And guess what the answer is? It's Christmas. Hmm. I suppose, I would say in that criteria alone, it's probably a Christmas movie. But let's move on anyway. There's a few more tweets for us to gather pace. I used to watch this. No, that's not me talking. That's the username. I used to watch this. It's a podcast. You might want to check those guys out. Who said, yes, it's a Christmas movie. I always wondered if they found Holly's watch after the end. Sure, it was a long drop, but it was a good watch and might have landed on top of hands. Could have been salvageable. Yeah, no one even thought about that because, of course, we hear about the watch at the beginning of the movie. It's the gift. And, of course, it's ultimately what leads to, well, I wouldn't say it leads to the death of Hans. But, of course, that's how they end up killing him.
Yeah, is there something symbolic in that? We were talking about money before and symbols of the film. She sacrifices the watch, which is worth a lot of money, $4,000, if I remember rightly. Which obviously, if you adjust for inflation, it's going to be a lot more now, over 30 years later.
Yeah, that's true. And I think it's like maybe the wife's way of saying that I chose a career over love, but now I'm going to choose love back over my career. Maybe something as corny as that. And do you think?
I think it was more a life over the watch, wasn't it?
Well, it wasn't a tree shock, was it? So I don't know whether it will have survived the fall.
I suppose so. But anyway, let's roll on.
You better watch out.
Sean at Sean 605-36208 said that it's based on R. Thorpe's book, Nothing Lasts Forever. I think it may have been referenced in our factoid section earlier in the show. He said that the teddy bear is McTiernan's and it's also used in The Hunt for Red October. Now, that's an interesting one that we never picked up on.
Well, yeah, because that's set on a submarine, isn't it?
There you go. And to get a true reaction, Rickman was actually dropped 40 foot for the climax. Again, something that we all missed there. Eastwood wanted to make his own film of the book, and it was supposed to be a sequel to Commando, which I thought was interesting. I wasn't aware of that one. Sean also went on to say that if Home Alone is considered the Christmas movie, then Die Hard is also a Christmas movie. And then he provided this logic, which I think is quite good. A sole hero left to stop enemy infiltrators in a building on Christmas in order to be with his family. Who am I? John McClane or Kevin McAllister or both? The wet bandits would have died in real life. So there you go. I think if we hadn't cleared it up before, I think Sean may have just cleared it up for us. And then last two, Soundtrack Podcast at The Soundtrack Guys said it's definitely a Christmas flick. And Nick Church at ChurchyChurch14 simply left a poop emoji, which I take is his opinion that the film is crap. So correct me if I'm wrong, Nick, but that just about wraps up our feedback. As always, guys, anyone that messaged in, thank you so much. We always appreciate the feedback to our movie reviews. And of course, if there was anything that I've missed, I do apologise. I do try and read them all before we go to recording. J-Dog.
Thank you for your tweets and keep it up.
Well said.
Q&A.
It's the part of the show now when we test each other's knowledge of the movie, of Die Hard. I'm going to be taking a step back from this one because we have our guest, Anthony, on the show. So, Anthony, do you have three questions?
I do. Question number one, J-Dog. You mentioned earlier about the different states that the vest tops that John McClane wore. Obviously, as the movie got on, there was more blood, more dirt. Obviously, depending on what scene they were filming that day, he needs to have a set number of different tops ready to go. Do you know how many vest tops he had in wardrobe in different states of decay?
17.
Spot on.
Well, you know, you should have known, and known me so long, that I'm a John McClane vest aficionado. No, actually, you know, I'm sure we've all researched from the same pot.
Well, based on tonight, it looks like matching haircut too, John. I mean, J-Dog.
What, the widow's pee?
Well, yeah, I suppose. The envy of me and Anthony, I suppose. Go fire away, Ant.
The second one.
Sorry, can I just say, so far in our podcast, because you don't have a picture of me, JD has likened me to some sort of strange creature from Masters of the Universe, an ugly troll of some sort, or a wizard or something like that. I'm now being called John McClane. Well, I'll take that one, actually.
That's a compliment. Come on.
It is.
So, second question for you, J-Dog. Sergeant Al Powell, how many kids did he have?
You know, the first line that came to my mind was one from Total Recall. Man, I've got 5 kids to feed. 2.
No, it's incorrect. It's a bit of a trick question. He had none, but his wife was working on his first.
Ah, okay. Oh, good question, that, actually.
And finally, I think it was just mentioned in the reader feedback there. Alan Rickman was dropped 40 foot. Do you know what trick they played on him to get the reaction?
Did they tell him that the wire had snapped or something like that?
No, they told him they'll drop him on 3, 2, 1, go. They let go on number 2.
Oh, right. Okay, so let me just put this in my head. So they dropped him, obviously, at normal speed. They recorded him doing the reaction with the watch and then realising that he's fallen to his death, and then they just slowed it down.
Yeah, that's a high speed, I think.
But they did it on 2, which, because I think when he first drops, there's a sort of look in his eye, like his eyes widen, like you do when you're shocked. It's a great shot, that, isn't it?
I don't know if it's good acting or real fear. I'm going to go with real fear.
Yeah, I would be, even if I felt completely safe. I hate anything to do with heights. So, you know, I wouldn't. I just would dislike anything like that whatsoever. But that's really good. Much better than a shot in a film released year before, RoboCop, at the end of the film when the baddie drops from the building. And as he falls down, bizarrely, and anyone who's seen RoboCop will know this, the baddie's arms appear almost stretched out. They look like they're made of clay or puppetry or something, you know, like, bit like in A Nightmare on Elm Street when Freddy's arms come out and they're scraping along the walls. It's bizarre. If you haven't seen that clip, go and check it out. It's when Dick Murdoch gets killed.
So how many was that out of 3, Anthony, did J-Dog get there?
Just the one, first question.
Just one. So there you go. If you get 2 right, Anthony, you are the episode's winner. J-Dog, have you got 3 questions to fire to Anthony?
I do, yes. When John phones Argyle in the limo for the first time, what's beside Argyle?
Is it the teddy bear?
It is the teddy bear, yeah. Bizarrely, the teddy bear is sat in the seat next to him.
Before John arrives?
No. When he's in the building.
Ah, right, okay.
What is John McClane's ex-wife's maiden name, which she reverts back to?
Gennaro.
It is Gennaro, yeah. It's also
we even got a bit of an accent there, nice.
Yeah, it is Gennaro, and that's also one of the names from the novel as well. Why does she do that? There's a reason, a specific reason why she says in the film.
Is it Japanese culture?
Yeah, it's to do with Japanese culture, that's right, yeah. Something she starts to say something about if they thought she was married, then et cetera, et cetera. You're doing well here. He's doing well, isn't he, JD?
Well, is that 3 out of 3?
It is, yeah, indeed.
Fantastic. Oh, okay. Absolutely. You are the John McClane of the episode. J-Dog, you are the Hans, Gruber.
Well, I do have some additional questions, but fair's fair.
No, come on. I'll join in now if I know these extra ones. Why not just throw them out there? Come on.
Okay.
If you've took the time to prepare them, why not?
It's an easy one, this. What's written on the jumper when McClane sends the bad guys? Is it Carl or his brother, Carl's brother, I'm not sure, what's written on his jumper?
Is it just Merry Christmas, ho, ho, ho?
It is now I've got a machine gun, ho, ho, ho.
Oh, very good. He's got it. He snatched it away from you, JD.
That's the one. I set him up there.
when John is in the vent, and by the way, who knew vents were so strong? When he's in the vent, he says, now I know what a blank feels like. What's the blank?
It's a great question, because I can remember the line, but for whatever reason, it's not coming to me. Anthony, you've got a big beaming smile on your face, so why didn't you put me out of my misery?
A microwavable dinner.
Oh, very formal, and TV dinner, but I'll give you that nonetheless.
Now I'm going to knock that down to half a point. right, let's move on and talk about our favourite scenes and characters.
Favourite scene.
Anthony, kick us off. What comes to mind for you as a favourite scene?
Obviously, it's got to be where McLean actually meets Hans. It's one of them movie things that you don't usually see. Usually when the bad guy meets the good guy, there's a big fight, a shootout or something. This twists it all on its head. He meets Hans. Hans pretends to be one of the hostages who's escaped, puts on this American accent. And you think, oh no, he's got McLean here. McLean gives him a gun and you think, this is it, it's over. Only to find out that McLean knew all along and has not put any bullets in the gun. And just the emotions switching back and forth within that scene, I think, are brilliant.
Yeah, it's clever as well, isn't it? Because just to outline the reason why he gave him a gun without any bullets in is he's looking over his shoulder at a list of the names of the people who were in the building. And can you remember the name, the phony name? Well, not the phony name, but the name of the employee that he gives?
Oh! I get this. I'll tell you what, Anthony. Is it Clay?
Mm. It is indeed. It's Clay. Does he get him on the fact, though, that he says he's on a certain floor? Because next to it says what floor that person works on.
Well, I don't understand why that would be of any noteworthiness, because, of course, he'd fled from the party, hadn't he? So it could have been anyone. I did actually think about the rationale for showing that. I just thought that was Hans' way of quick thinking. Like, I immediately remembered the name of an employee. I don't know, but it also kind of showed that McLean's a smart guy. He might look rough around the edges, but he's wise. He's streetwise. He picks up on all these things. And it's like a bit earlier on, every time he hears one of the terrorist's name, he's writing it down on his arm. All these little things kind of just kind of prop him up as, like I say, he's not this rough around the edges guy. He's a lot more than that, isn't he? He's as smart as Hans in some way.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know why, as I said earlier, the script was written very quickly just before filming. I don't know if you know why they inserted that scene in or what gave the writer that idea.
Something to do with the accents?
Yeah, they were in the canteen and someone said to Alan Rickman, so everyone can do an American accent, what's yours? So he just reeled off this accent and that gave the writer the idea. I know how they can meet in the film.
I suppose the only thing I'd say about that, it's like it loses its power once you've seen it. And I suppose you could say that about any film, of course, but it's like, I imagine the first time people seen that, it was just such a great moment, like maybe in the movie theatre or the cinema, which I always have to reference when we do our transatlantic podcasts, I suppose. And apologies to anyone that's beyond the transatlantic. But it's true, isn't it? It's like one of those great movie moments. It's like no one sees it coming until you've obviously seen it the second time. I mean, you can still enjoy it, of course. J-Dog, what about you? Any favourite scenes or moments from Die Hard?
Now, when I was reflecting on this, John, the research of the podcast, I thought to myself, if you would have asked me this question 20 years ago, I would have gone for something involving lots of action and fighting and shooting and that sort of stuff. But obviously, you get older, don't you? I hope you get a bit more mature. but your understanding of things and the subtleties of the film and the narrative and things like that become a bit more complex. And so there were any scenes that involved John and his wife before all of this happened, because in any film, particularly action films, but in any film, you've got to have a reason why why does this person want to do this? What is the driving factor? What's the motivation? And I don't mean that in that in the drama sense, you know, what's my motivation for the scene? I mean, what is the character's motivation for the film? Why? What are the stakes here involved? And the stakes are obviously his wife and her life and that. But when you see that set up between the two of them, and yes, you know that she's his ex, but when they see each other, there's that spark that we talked about before, which gives some potential of hope. Now, I'm not sat there watching the film going, I hope these get back together. It's not like that kind of thing. You know, it's not a soap opera. But it's in that, these are the stakes and this is the potential gain from the film. So it gives it a drive.
It seems to be a sort of first date nerves when they first see each other. And you're sort of like, ooh, what's going to happen? Are they going to end up together? Is it a love story that they end up together at the end?
That's true, yeah, yeah. Also, I'd mention as well, not necessarily scenes, but there's some really clever musical work going on in the background here that I only noticed this time round. They take, or the I'm not sure who did the music, but they take certain songs and they put them in an action, how do I describe it? An action sounding way. So, for example, you hear at one point Walking in a Winter Wonderland being played in the theme, in the style of the movie, like a movie score version of it. And I think they do it with a couple of other songs as well. One of the themes, certainly the bad guy's theme, seems to be Beethoven's Ode to Joy. They play that quite a bit, or people whistle it or sing it, but it's also used in the score as well, in a way, in a sort of action movie type version of Ode to Joy too. So that's quite clever as well. I've never noticed that before.
Like I mentioned earlier, the bit where Al's about to leave and he throws the bad guy out, the shot is out of the windscreen from inside the car, watching the bad guy fall as let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
Yeah, is that called non-didactic music?
You know, we said before about the plaza being a character itself, and of course the music. I mean, maybe Die Hard doesn't have that iconic theme that some of the movies around the time did, or certainly around the earlier 80s. But the music definitely plays its part, doesn't it? And it's used in, you know, a couple of ways. Obviously, you've got the Christmas nods. And then we were just saying before about some of the classical music. The scene when they finally enter the vault or open the vault, of course, it's Joyful, Joyful. And you get this bright light. It's almost like they're standing on stage. It's really cleverly done, isn't it? Really interesting.
Yeah.
What about characters? We won't spend too long because I think we've touched upon it in our general chit-chat. Maybe some of our fringe characters like Al. Anything we can say on Al, who has a big role at the end of the day, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does that same thing in the novel where the bad guy emerges from the wreckage and goes to shoot someone and he ends up shooting him back. Not, I can't really say he's a great character. He's a good character. He's a sympathetic character. But I don't really... When I was thinking back about the film before I watched it for the research, the podcast, he wasn't really a character that stuck in my mind as being someone who I was particularly endeared to. I understand, though, he's somebody who gives John an opportunity to not just wisecrack to himself, which he does, but also someone to bounce off and maybe learn a little bit more about McLean's character. I'm quite neutral on him, to be fair.
For me, I think I like him. He comes in as someone who, you know, he just gets his call. He doesn't seem to be bothered. He's buying Twinkies, as we mentioned. He goes down, he has a look around, and he says, gets to the hallway, he says, oh, the hell with this, as if to say, I can't be bothered, I'm just going home. And then he ends up becoming an integral part of the action. And he's not just, I don't think, someone to bounce off McLean. McLean sort of unloads his fears on him and his tell me wife when I get out, you know, that I love her. It's someone he can relate to on the outside because he doesn't have anyone on the inside. It gives him that personality, that vulnerability we spoke about.
Yeah, that's fair enough, Ant. What about the Argyle character then?
Yeah, he's an interesting guy. Likeable. There's nothing to say that, you know, he certainly doesn't do anything that would piss you off during the film. He's just kind of, it's maybe some comedy value at some stage.
Is there a deliberate attempt there to insert someone very much like Eddie Murphy?
Well, I didn't pick up on that, but now that you mention it, I can see why you would. I know what you mean. It's like he does feel a little shoehorned in some sense. He's just there, isn't he? And of course, he he's the drop-off. And, of course, he waits around, doesn't he, in the event that Bruce Willis might need to go back, which obviously doesn't happen. Yeah, strange inclusion, but what do you think, Andy? Does he add anything that maybe we've missed?
I may be wrong here, but I think I read that he's not actually in the book. He was inserted just for the movie only. Again, I'm not sure what his character actually brings, apart from maybe a little bit of humour. There was no reason why McLean couldn't have been dropped off and the limo driver walk away to me.
Maybe they felt like they needed that bit of comic release or comic relief in the film because it is very dark. But then on the other hand, McLean does a lot of wisecracking himself, doesn't he?
I think the movie is a funny movie. The director actually requested more comedy in there, I think.
And I think obviously these films aren't made in a vacuum, are they? Around about that time, mid to late 80s, the comedy sidekick was very much a thing then. In fact, so many of the things in this film that they do reference, they do reference Stallone and Schwarzenegger by name and Rambo. These were well-established characters, weren't they, by the time this film was out? It's very wise about the context in which it's being made. I used to think about 80s action films as being just this one thing, but they're not really. You can chart the progress over the space of about 4, 5, 6 years. A lot happens in those 4, 5, 6 years. So much so that a film like this can be made, and they can, in a similar way to Last Action Hero did later down the line, same director, it can poke fun at the what's become the cliches of the genre.
Yeah, no, I suppose a last point on Argyle, if you remember that journey to the plaza when, you as you said, Anthony, Bruce is in the front seat or John McClane's in the front seat, that's the point when he starts opening up and we start to get a bit more insight into his character. And of course, it's Argyle that kind of plugs that out of him. He's a wise crack kid, isn't he? He's just kind of, he's not afraid to be bolshy with John McClane. He starts to kind of find out a bit about him and the fact that, you know, the reason why he hasn't joined his wife is because he's committed to his job. So maybe it's just as simple as that. But one of the characters I wanted to just quickly touch upon before we move on and talk about, you know, Die Hard 30 years on is the wife. Is it Nancy, did we say her name was?
Holly.
Holly, so not even close.
Oh, it is a Christmas film. She's called Holly.
Holly. When I first sometimes watch this, I always think, well, certainly from the first half of the film, does the film hint in any way, and maybe you might completely disagree with this, that she's having an affair and maybe this guy, that this douchebag who's, you know, snorting in the office and things like that, is there something more, you know, is the film trying to lead us to not trust Holly? Anyone else pick up on that?
I didn't. I felt like he was chasing her, and it was sort of, for me, that was the alternative if it didn't work out with John. It was that's where she'd end up with the sleazebag who's chasing, he's asking her out for dinner. You know, he's trying to impress her with the watch and things. And sort of, for me, that was where, if it doesn't work out with John when he comes up, she might go down that route, but I don't think she'd gone there yet.
Yeah, I think it's a fair point, actually, Ant. He gives the impression that they're together, and he gets sort of defensive, doesn't he, and territorial when McLean turns up. But in actuality, I sense a bit of a coldness there between those two. Because if she really wants to show John that she was with this guy now, this sleazy fella, then she'd have done that, wouldn't she? She'd have been a bit more over the top and showing off and that and saying, look at the watch. I think, in fact, it's actually the fella who says, look at the watch. He's the one who kind of bragged. You know, it's almost like he's seeing it as a possession, which comes back to the idea of the film being set in a context of a company that's obsessed with money and material things. She seems she's trying to distance herself from that because she clearly carries something still for John.
I mean, she has the picture in the office, doesn't she?
That's right, yeah. Well, that's what leads Hans Gruber to identifying her as being related to.
But I've never understood why she puts the picture face down. I don't know why she did that. I don't know if you...
More obvious.
She's in the office and she slams it down. So that he has to pick it up later on. So that's how he doesn't realise until he picks up. I don't know why she put it down. I've never figured that out.
What was this? What had happened then for Talitha to do that? What had happened just before?
Was it when she was on the phone and she called the nanny? and said, "Oh, you may need to make up the spare bed in case he stays." And then I think she got off the phone and put the frame face down so you couldn't see the picture. I don't know why.
Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I think there's enough hints in the movie to say that there's more strain on this relationship than just career change. I think there's a little bit more than that. And that's just maybe another hint, another layer, if you like, of she's just fed up. So I don't know. And obviously it kind of adds to our experience. But I think it's just, you know, more for the audience. It's another strain on the relationship and something, again, that makes it fighting for or worthwhile for John.
I think now I'm thinking about it, I don't think she wanted to give away that she was, you know, still interested in saving the relationship. She was sort of playing hard to get, maybe, and that's why she put the picture down in case he's seen it as a sign that he was still in there.
Movie legacy.
So here we are, 32 years after Die Hard first hit the big screen. We've had some sequels. It's still quite a well-known film, and of course, it has the luxury of being labelled by many as a Christmas film, which always helps when we talk about our legacy. But what about today, J-Dog, Die Hard?
Yeah, so the influence of this film on the action genre is definitely something to be looked at, and it probably deserves a podcast of its own. But the vulnerable side of the action hero that comes in this film is certainly something that was carried through into the 90s action films. I do think it was quite novel in that way, in that we saw things, we saw him with the glass in the feet, as we talked about, and getting hit, and the vest is symbolic of the pummeling that he's taken throughout the film. So I do think the lasting legacy certainly has been of the vulnerable hero who can die, and he's not some sort of overblown and oversized computer game character. I think also the comedy element of the film and the wisecracks was something that were influential but also influenced, like so much in this film, because it's easy to say, oh, we've never seen an action hero who's funny before. But in actuality, at this point in time, Arnold Schwarzenegger had made it, well, he certainly established himself. And if you think about Terminator, it was 1984. Well, that was a low-budget film, and he'd done a few acting gigs, but that was his biggest so far. Within the space of 4 years, by the time this film came out, he was up to a point in his career in 1988 with Twins, where he could actually play against type and play the comedy role and send up his usual action side. So I think comedy was certainly already, it was fertile ground, certainly, in that point to have an action film with comedy in it too. The film obviously had the legacy of its two sequels, which also took, as we've mentioned before, you've got the second film's got the airport as a character and the third film's got New York as a character. I'm not sure about the later sequels. I'd rather not even go there, if I'm being honest. But yeah, certainly an interesting one if you're doing a study of action films across the years. And I would also argue that the computer game, which came much later, actually, in 1995, Die Hard Trilogy, was influential in the early days of the PlayStation, influential on a number of different genres. Great game.
Is that the one where you were with Samuel L. Jackson in the cab and you had all the quotes?
That was the third, yeah. So the first one was a third-person action film based on the first, and the levels were like the levels of the Nakatomi Plaza. The second one was a shooting game where you were on rails, you just had to point and shoot. That was at the airport. And then the third one was a driving simulator based on driving around New York. Yeah, good times remembering that. 25 years old, that game.
It was a brilliant game. So for me, I think it did change the action movie genre. It did go from the, like we said, the big, hard, bulked up action hero to the funnier, more vulnerable guy who's, you know, battling not only the good guy, also the villains now became cleverer. The plans and the plots were more slick, well designed, well thought out. And then I think it went on to change. And you look at movies made after, it went from, you know, big open spaces like in the jungle for Predator to one guy in one situation. You look at Under Siege on a boat, Speed on a bus, Air Force One on a plane. It's the same sort of Die Hard movie, just a different character in a different setting.
Good point, that Ant, about the setting really does make, not make the film, but it's a huge part of it, isn't it? And especially where you've got a setting where the person's enclosed within that setting and there's no way of getting out of it. I mean, obviously the third film opened it up to the city, but yeah, one building or one bus or one cruise ship in the sequel to Speed 2 Cruise Control. Yeah. The other question is, what would happen if mobile phones were around when this film was out?
You've just stolen my point. I was going to make the very same. Because when me and J-Dog, you know, often talk about the impact of mobile phones, and no bigger impact than how crap it's made movies. Because you only have to look at some of the episodes we've discussed. I think we've mentioned this now, Chris, maybe 4 or 5 times, about how if this film were to be made today, the turmoil just wouldn't be on the same level. All the hostages would have been able to contact law enforcement. Bruce Willis would have been able to contact the police. All this, that stuff that's kind of you need to have a film like Die Hard and to feel the impact and the consequences is stolen with the use of a mobile phone. And it was the one thing I wrote down for the legacy is, and I'm starting to notice it more now when I sit and watch these films, is that, God, if only they had an iPhone, or if only they had a sat, all these things now come to mind, and I'm guessing it's because I've been doing this podcast. And I do actually think it's hampering what we now see, certainly on a movie-going experience, and definitely in the action genre, when you need those sorts of emotions. Mobile phones have robbed us, if not completely, somewhat. What do you think about that?
Yeah, isn't it a massive... It's actually a scene in itself when the phone lines get cut, because that is almost like, wow, the outside world is gone now. Because there's the guy who's got all the wires and he's twisting them together, and then there's the other guy, isn't there, who's just above him where the wires are going to, and he takes a chainsaw to them and just cuts through them.
That's right.
And it also leads to the fact that the only communication is radio, this old style communication. It's the only way Hans can speak to John. It's the only way John can speak to Al. It's this one radio channel that they're all around, they're all listening into.
I suppose if you were a really clever writer, you could kind of create a similar film whereby the guy who owns the plaza is a bit of an obnoxious freak. He doesn't want any mobile phones in his building, and you have to leave them in the foyer before you enter the elevator. You could do, I think that happens in The Dark Knight, doesn't it? Where he says we don't have cell phones in the building. So if you're a clever enough writer, I suppose there are ways. But it's just something that popped up. I thought, damn these smartphones. But anyway, I think this is the point in the show where we give it a mark out of 10. And Anthony, given that you are our guest host on today's episode, I think it's only fair and fitting. And I'm sure J-Dog would agree that we leave this one for you. So Die Hard 1988. What is your mark out of 10?
I wouldn't say it was perfect, but it's close. It's up there. It's got the comedy element. It's got all the action elements. So I'm going to give it an
8.5. There you go. There you have it. Anthony has given Die Hard an 8.5 out of 10, and it's set in stone now. J-Dog, you look like you're wincing. Are you disappointed with that vote?
No, I'm more than happy with it. On the point... Note, you have admonished me in the past, JD, for my use of decimal points.
Yes, I did wince myself when I heard the points, but, you know, Anthony's a guest, so we can let it slide. But anyway, without further ado, that just about wraps up our episode 14 review of Die Hard. We hope you've enjoyed listening to the review. We'll be back soon with another episode to dive into. And of course, thank you, Anthony, for being our guest host on the episode. Did you enjoy it?
I did very much so. Thanks for having me, chaps.
Pleasure.
You're more than welcome. Right, guys, that's everything, and we'll see you next time.
Goodbye.
See you next time, nerds.